Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast and new episode. This is an actual proper new episode recorded with my great friend Peter Hallier. We're not back to regular new episodes yet. At the moment, young podcast Mike has been putting together some amazing episodes of the show, themed episodes where he takes various guests talking about similar subjects and has put them together, and they've been absolutely wonderful. So if you have not checked those out, I recommend doing so. You get a whole new appreciation of some of those topics, hearing various people talk about them back to back, and Michael has done a brilliant job putting those shows together. But I wanted to squeeze in this one with my great mate Pete Hallier because he has a new show on at the moment, which I think is worth supporting. It's called How to Stay Married. You can check that out on 10 Play or, you know, live to air on Channel 10, like the old-fashioned way that people watch television. He's also on The Project. He's got books. He's one of the most prolific, entertaining, wonderful people that I know in the comedy industry. He genuinely is probably an underrated genius, I would say, Peter Hallier. He's probably the most loved, beloved comedian of all. Everybody loves Pete. He has a way of speaking to everybody. He can be super intelligent and he can be super broad, often all in the one joke. He has a great gift for humanity and for love and for compassion and finding comedy that is in the middle of those things. Anyway, I love this chat with Pete. I could have talked to him for hours and hours and hours. It was immediately after work. We were both pretty buggered. Pete had to rush off to get to The Project, one of his various other jobs. So it didn't go for as long as I would have loved to. And there were so many things I would have loved to talk to Pete about. But this is definitely one of those episodes where I would love to get another chance to sit down for another hour and a half with Pete and talk about some other stuff. The dogs are barking in the background, so I need to finish up this intro. I've got a quick plug to do. Sydney Comedy Store, December 7 to 15. I'm doing some work in progress shows, which means I'm going to get to the store without much of an idea about what next year's show is going to be. And I'm hopefully going to discover what it's going to be in that week or so of shows. So come on down and watch that happen. They're always fun shows to see, and, you know, they're cheaper for a reason. So Sydney Comedy Store, December 7 to 15. So that's just like in a week and a half. Enjoy this episode with Pete and enjoy the rest of the compilation episodes that Michael's put together. And then we'll be back with some new episodes in the next few months. Okay, the dogs are really barking in the background now. I have to go. Bye. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson, the host of the podcast. My name's in the title, Philosophy with Will Anderson. Every week, and when I say every week, clearly I've had about 6 months off, so not really every week at all, but I'm back. The point is I'm back and could not be back with a better episode. This is how it starts. I always ask the guests who they are. Who are you?
My name is Peter Hallier, and you might recognize me from Har Nice Headliners. just thought I'd throw a little bit of nostalgia in, Will.
Well, I mean, the good people at Har Nice have been wrapped with the shout out. Is Har Nice even a product that is still available in this day and age?
I'm not sure if it is. Did you do Har Nice Headliners?
I did. I don't think I ever did Har Nice Headliners.
So Har Nice Headliners was a comedy, one of the Comedy Channel's first kind of local productions when Foxtel kind of began. And the Comedy Channel began, hosted by Marty Sheargold, filmed at the Comedy Club. And each episode was like two comics, and Marty would shoot a little bit with you backstage or during a day, picking you up to do the gig, and then you just do a gig. It was I think I did mine with Akmal, from memory. Thought I'd just throw that one in. I was tossing up between that and Radio Wise. Do you remember Radio Wise?
Now, what was Radio Wise?
Radio Wise.
So Radio Wise. I love all these old things, by the way. I love going back and going, what exactly did we do on that? I remember one of my favorites was mouthing off with Richard Feidler.
Yes.
Richard Feidler had a politically incorrect style, you know, show called, I think it was called Mouthing Off.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I never did that. But Radio Wise was it was basically where they would it wasn't a TV thing. Strangely enough, it was a radio thing where they would record gigs, and then they would Radio Wise was the company that would then sell bits of your material to, mainly I think it was Triple M that were doing it, and maybe a bit of Fox. And they would, throughout the day, they would play live from the Star and Garter, "This is Peter Hellyer," and they'd do a little bit of fish and chips or something. And then, but you got paid like $120 or something. So that was like, you know, when you're scratching around trying to, you know, subsidize your Dan Murphy's wage. That was, and then you heard, you know, occasionally be driving around, you hear yourself on the radio. It was pretty cool.
Do you remember the first time, would have been the first time that you like were able to be the audience for your own work? Because that's something that often when somebody doesn't like my work, there is a part of me that is like, yeah, I get that. Like, A, comedy is very subjective.
Yes.
And B, my comedy isn't even necessarily the sort of comedy that I enjoy consuming myself.
Yeah.
Like, if I were a comedy festival punter and going out to buy tickets to things, I'm not sure that my show would be the sort of thing that I would go and see. It's the sort of thing that I do.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily, it's not like at the festival I go, I'm going to go and see another 10 people who are doing comedy, like the comedy that I do.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I think I'm the same way. I'm not even sure if I even think about it too much, but I think, and I end up choosing people who are quite different to me. You know, I'll see Alex Edelman, who, you know, is very different than what I do, and other people. But yeah, I mean, that was probably the first time I'd probably heard myself and thought of the audience, you know, in that kind of way. I always love sitting in audiences, and I still think it's important, you know, at festivals. I think sometimes I go see other shows just to sit in the audience and remember what it's like to be in the audience of a comedy show, and that I look around and they all want to enjoy the show. And when you're backstage, you're not thinking like that.
Yeah.
You're thinking,
you think this is like 500 people who've each paid $50 each to come out and hate me, to have a terrible time.
How weird is that? Like, you still think like that. You know, I'm probably over that a little bit. Like, you kind of go, no, most of the people are here in the right frame of mind. There might be a handful of people who have been dragged here. Maybe they wanted to go see you, or, you know, or Jude, or somebody else, and you know, their girlfriend won, or somebody maybe had a bad day, maybe didn't really feel like coming out, but maybe we can, you know, maybe I can get them, you know, I can turn them around. But yeah, I still love sitting in the audience and even listening to the music people play, because I always, I'm sure you do as well, I choose my house music very carefully, and I just, you know, I love the lights going down and it's that experience.
One of the things that I find interesting about sitting in an audience is that idea that when you're on stage, you need everybody to be enjoying, like, my mindset as the performer is, if somebody's laughing at every sixth joke, you almost, yeah, if you were looking at that person, you'd be like, oh, this is going no good.
They're not
laughing at every single joke.
Yeah.
But when you're in an audience, you remember, oh, that's the point of an audience. That's why an audience is a good thing. Because no one's laughing at every single joke at the show.
No.
Like, only an insane person would literally be laughing at every joke that you've written that you go, this is a great line, this is a great line. If someone came along and laughed at every single one of those jokes, A, it would be completely exhausting for them. But B, that would mean they were so on, like, they'd be a stalker, essentially.
Yeah.
Because they'd be so into you.
They are more than welcome to come to other shows and, you know, pay full price, obviously. But absolutely. And, you know, there's the old thing that sometimes we all fix on the person that isn't laughing in the crowd. But sometimes when I'm watching other comedians, you know, I do look around at the crowd, and I see sometimes, and this, when you're on stage, you don't appreciate it, but sometimes people are just smiling and taking it in and enjoying it, you know. And some people are big laughers and other people are doing it more internally. That's not the most fun thing for a person on stage, but sometimes I did a gig at a winery on the weekend with Merrick Watts is running at the moment, and it was Nikki Britton, Tom Gleason, Becky Lucas and Akmal. And I particularly was watching the audiences when Becky and Nikki were on, and there were so many kind of women like kind of hitting each other in the arm going, yeah, you do that, you know, like, now, whether they constituted laughs for the comedian on stage, it was an absolute connection there. So it's, and yeah, I told him that.
I killed tonight. So many of the audience members came out bruised from the experience. Show me your arms. How did I go?
Yeah, exactly. If they don't come out scratched, bruised and bleeding, then I haven't had a good gig.
Are you a person who feels comfortable? Because I imagine, like, you know, say, for example, your television show at the moment, How to Stay Married, that you are involved in the edit of that as well, aren't you?
Yes.
So that means that you are spending a reasonable amount of time watching yourself perform. Are you a person that does that? So, for example, when you're doing a stand-up show, are you the sort of person that, like, records it? Do you watch it back? Are you comfortable watching yourself, you know, perform?
I am enough. I don't search myself out to you know, I don't go home and watch the late edition of the project each night.
Larry Sanders style?
No.
Laying in bed with Bridget.
Lying in bed with Sharon Stone. that documentary is amazing, by the way. If have you seen the Larry Sanders that Judd Apatow did?
I haven't seen it yet, but I am looking forward to seeing it.
It's amazing. But I'm comfortable enough. If I think it's gone really well, I tend not to watch it back, because if I can avoid it, this is not if I'm part of the edit and all that, but then I won't watch it back, because I think that lives perfectly in my mind. And I don't need to see what I did wrong.
Yeah.
So I won't watch it back. If I think it didn't go as well, I might watch it back to see what I could improve on. Stand-up, I record myself a lot. Most gigs I record. And it's been, I think iPhone's one of the great things. And I know you've recorded yourself, I think, for even back with mini discs and stuff. Is that, am I accurate?
I record a lot.
Yeah.
Whether I listen back, though, to recordings is... Yeah. Is like, I mean, this current show, I think I've recorded every single night that I've done, but I've only listened back to an entire show.
So, yeah, so you record, and I still record, like, throughout my festival run, I record every show I do, and you do a lot more shows. Your runs are a lot longer than mine. But when do you start deleting? Like, when do you start? Do you go, like, well, there's nothing new in that show, so I don't need that?
Nah, they're all still in my phone. You could actually recreate my entire... If you had my phone, there'd be about two shows missing from the entire tour, and they were only nights where, A, either the recording didn't work, I mashed the wrong button with my fingers as I was walking out, or like happened the other night in Noosa, I left my phone charger in Townsville the night before, so I was charging my phone backstage on Justin's, so I couldn't take it out on stage. And of course, that's a show where I come up with three or four really good lines in the show. That's pretty much the only reason I ever recorded is like if I come up with some great bit of improv, or the joke comes out in a way that has never come out before, so I can go back and go, why did it come out better tonight than it's been coming out those other times, and have a listen to that?
That's the reason I do it as well, just to find those little bits that come out. And then I would tend to keep maybe half a dozen on my phone or recorded for prosperity and, you know.
The thing that I always find when I listen back is I'm reminded that when I'm going into something, particularly a new show and these sort of things, you have this idea that somehow you want to make it word perfect or that, you know, that you need to get it perfect. Whereas what I realize when I listen back is, even on the nights where I think that I got it perfect, it is so far from perfect.
Yeah. And I certainly have a discomfort listening to my voice back and listening, because I had the same thing. I think it feels better in my head than when I listen back to it. But that's also tempered by the fact that the audience is giving a reaction, whether it's a great night or an average night. I do. It's important, I think. I think you know, the apps and iPhones have been such a massive thing for comedians.
What about external feedback? Like, how much of it do you take on board? Like, where are you getting it from? Are there people that you particularly look to for external feedback? And then, like, you know, what is your kind of attitude to taking it? Are you good with taking it? You know, I mean, just give us a sense of that.
I love it. I love getting feedback because, and for me, I know straight away whether you think, you know, it's a good idea or not, whether it might help. I go away for a weekend with Tom Gleason every year. We've done that for the last 6 years or so. And it's usually around the time where we're both writing shows. And we'll go to places we've been to, Cairns, Port Douglas. We were in Newcastle recently. We've been to Mandurah, WA. And we'll do, you know, basically shows in front of theatres that are similar to the kind of, you know, place we'll be playing at the Comedy Festival. Maybe a bit smaller, but, you know, 400, 500, 600 people. And it's the best time to, you know, to try a lot of stuff, you know, because you've got not only an audience which is there and captive and excited, but you've also got, well, I've got one of the best comics in the country, and we actually watch each other's shows. We basically spend, you know, a couple of days talking, you know, doing these shows, going back to one of our hotel rooms, opening some wine, and talking about family, a gig, and comedy, and just our careers, and it's just, it's really lovely, you know, and but we will watch each other and give each other a lot of feedback, and openly, like, there's no embarrassment as far as going, this bit, you know, it's not working. What, you know, what can I do? Or do you think it's, you know, is there something in this? Or, and it's, I love having those conversations, and I'm happy to have those conversations with any, you know, comic, and anyone who's at the gig, I guess. I run a lot of stuff by my wife. Before, you know, before she hasn't actually come to a lot of gigs. She'll come when it's finished, you know, when it's working. But I run a lot of stuff by her. She actually comes up with a lot of stuff, to be honest.
Yeah. So that's right. Interesting to me because, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, if you're going to talk about your life together, it's probably worth her having some visibility on that. You don't want to put together like a 15-minute story about something that happened to, you know, her and you and the kids or something and work it out and get it up and it's like the main bit of your show and then she comes along and says, I'm not really sure you should be talking about that publicly.
I know.
Thank you, Peter.
She's been very good. Like, there was one bit I did in a show called One Hot Mess, which was about me and my spank bank, if you like, and the idea that, you know, she may not be the only person in there, and like, she's got the 5-star hotel room with the French, you know, 4-poster bed and the artworks on the wall, but she's maybe not aware that next door there's a scout hall with lots of other people in there. And I had this kind of bit where I was like introducing her to all the other people in my spank bank, from, you know, various celebrities to, you know, bridesmaids at a wedding, and you know, and that was the bit that I kind of was uncomfortable kind of saying to her, you know, I want to do this this bit, because it was, yeah, there's a certain truth to it, but, you know, it was exaggerated. As all of it is, you know, there's sometimes, I mean, with How to Stay Married at the moment, there's a lot of stuff about our lives in that show, but it's usually the seed of it is the truth, and then we take it somewhere else.
So how do you, that's an interesting thing to me, because like Billy Connolly, you know, said once that of course, you know, you exaggerate things and of course you lie, because if people wanted to see a documentary, there'd be just someone up there, you know, building a fence. Real life is mostly boring.
Yeah.
Sometimes there is a seed of a perfect moment in a story or whatever, but it's often you taking one aspect of it and then exaggerating it to a point where it is, you know, perfect and comedic or whatever it needs to be. So that journey from something being kind of half true, or like, you know, having a real seed of truth in it, but then being exaggerated out to that place you can take it on stage.
Yeah.
How do you know when's far enough and when's too far in, you know,
that? There's a good example I can think of with me when years ago, I did a routine about my dad getting button-up jeans and how he really struggled to get the buttons undone. And it was true. That was true. Like, I mean, we're getting very frustrated with his button-up jeans. You know, you just, once you're a zipper man at that age, you just save the zippers. But so, and I extended it to a memory which is completely made up of basically my dad pissing his pants at the circus because he couldn't get his button up pants undone in time. And I did it about 3 or 4 times, and I just thought, I can't do this. Like, my dad's going to see this. His friends are going to see it. I might end up being broadcast at some point of it. Go, you know, like, Well, I can't have his friends at the village where he lives now, but this is years ago, but yeah, the local bowls club, thinking he pissed his pants at the circus. That's not fair on him. He doesn't deserve that. So,
I mean, there'll be a point in his life where he gets the age where the majority of his group have pissed their pants in public at some stage. It might be very relatable.
I think if I just wait a few more years, getting some more button-up jeans and taking to the circus, yeah. I could probably then do the routine.
Reverse engineer it.
So that was, I think, an example of going, okay, I've gone too far. There was an example in the show it's on there at the moment, How to Stay Married, where my wife had a story that she's told, we've spoken a lot about over the years, where her English teacher accused her of plagiarism. She wrote a poem, and the teacher said, "You didn't write this." Mm. You know, she didn't. This is pre-internet, so there was no, you know, yeah. It wasn't like about jumping on Google.
It did start with "I love a sunburnt country." Though,
There was a man from Nantucket, yeah. and it just destroyed my wife's confidence in English. You know, and I've seen some of my wife's writing, and she's very good. You know, who knows what could have been ahead of her. But it just really destroyed her, and she was so angry about it. So I always had the idea that one day I would be able to almost right the wrong for her in a script form or comedy. So there's an episode of How to Stay Married where Lisa McCune's character goes to her high school reunion, and her character has just returned to the workforce and is working in publishing. And the teacher who had accused her of plagiarizing hears about the publishing, and it's just like saying how ironic it is that you're working in publishing, and it's laughing. And then it's like, well, you know, why is it ironic? She goes, oh, it wasn't really your forte, was it, writing? And she goes, it was my forte. I didn't have any other fortes. It was my forte. And then, so that's almost up until that point. That's the truth. It's played out in different form at a high school reunion many years later. But that's sure. That's all true. But then we have to work out, okay, well, what works with TV? What works for entertainment? And I'm still trying to kind of fight the fight for my wife and kind of go, I want to make this a point. But the fact is, it's funnier and it works better for us if they go off and they dig up the time capsule where the poem is buried. And Lisa's character reads the poem in front of everybody, and when she reads the poem, she realizes that it's actually Billy Joel's River of Dreams. That she had completely wiped from her memory that pop cultural moment, and was, you know, in South Africa on safari with her family, and just wake up in the middle of the night. Mm. There's a little clue early in the episode, and wrote this poem. So that doesn't play out in my wife's favour, but that's just funnier.
So then, this is interesting to me, which is, have you ever had an instance? So I'll give you the example, because you saw We're Legal, my show about the arrest. So
amazing,
we can talk about that. So that is a true story.
Yes.
But it is a show about a real thing that happened to me, and it is not, it's a thing that happens over 30 hours, and the show doesn't go for 30 hours.
Yeah,
I mean, some nights it almost does, but you know, the show goes for an hour and a half maximum.
Yes.
And so you're condensing. I'm still, by the very nature of what I've chosen to point out is important on this journey, it might feel like I'm giving you a complete picture of that day, but the truth is that, you know, like, for example, just a really small example to make this point is, there's a bit in the show where I talk about being in the lounge eating carrot cake, and as I'm doing one thing, they call my flight, right? Well, they didn't. There was 40 minutes in between when that bit happens and when I get on the plane, but nothing interesting happened in that 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So for the nature of storytelling, I don't go, and then I walked around the airport for 40 minutes, and this, you know... So suddenly in my mind...
I feel ripped off that you didn't include that, but I mean...
Oh, don't worry. I tried to make it work. I had this whole idea about how suspicious it must have looked that I was just doing laps of the airport. Anyway, whatever. Never could make it work. But then that becomes in my mind. I have to remind myself now that I've told that story over and over and over again that that's not actually exactly how it happens. Because by the very nature of me saying it, over and over again and needing to believe it in that moment to make it convincing for the audience, then it almost rewires your brain in a way that you start to think, well, hang on, did, you know, Bridget, you know, at high school, you know, submit Billy Joel's River of Dreams, you know, rather than what the actual story, you know, is.
That happens to me, I think, quite a bit, where I've reinforced it so many times in my own mind, it changes, you know, the historical facts. And I'm not sure whether it concerns me or not, to be honest, because it kind of, if it's a nicer version of the truth, I can live with it. Yeah, it's funny actually, because Bridge literally was chatting this morning, and she was saying how, I think her brother had said to her, they'd watched an episode of How to Stay Married, and she goes, oh yeah, I can really imagine you and Pete having that conversation. And she's like, well, yeah, but it's not actually me and Pete. It's two different characters. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, we've had to change some bits. I joked. I said, yeah, we've actually had to cut out all the silent treatment that you give me after an argument. And like that wouldn't work for TV. We have to cut out all the days of silent treatment to get to the resolution at the end of the episode.
I mean, but what a brave and exciting episode that would be. Like, if you're in, say, season 5,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it'd be like the restaurant episode of, the Chinese restaurant episode of Seinfeld. You know, like, that thing of going, you guys have an argument in the first 30 seconds, and then literally the rest of the episode is just her giving you the silent treatment.
But it's funny, because I did think of it, because what a great thing that we've all experienced in relationships is the silent treatment. How can we do an episode about the silent treatment? And you know, it probably is M trying to give Greg the silent treatment, but then realizes she actually really needs to tell him something.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so, yeah, I think there is an idea there somewhere. Yeah.
So I'm interested particularly in this area where it comes to relationships, because when you're taking something from your real life and that you are going to later extrapolate on, often those things can come from moments of conflict, or they can come, like, you know, the most interesting or exciting things are going to be, you know, when you're going through something bad, or you're having an argument about something or whatever. How do you stay in the moment in a way that honors your partner in, like, you know, she needs you to be in this argument at the moment, having the argument, as opposed to half of your brain already being off going, this will make a great episode of, you know, How to Stay Married.
It may be the single biggest issue in our relationship that my mind drifts off. I live in half a fairyland. I really, like, it's not, and I don't understand a lot of stuff that real people have to understand. You know, I haven't cared enough about superannuation. I don't, you know, there's stories in the news, I'm just like, you know, I'm on a news show, and I'm just like, I don't even know what this is about. let's get to the fun stuff. You know, I grew up watching movies and believing in them.
Yeah.
You know, like you know, I think it's worked out all right for me. And you know, that if you do good things will happen to you. And the good guy usually wins. My mind drifts off, because it's either, I'm thinking of something that there's something that Bridget said, which I'm thinking, like you just said, that could make a good routine. And sometimes I will do that. Like Bridget's understanding, you know, sometimes I'll go, actually, I need to write that down. That's actually pretty funny. And unless it's like a serious, like unless it's like a yelling match, which we don't have too many of, to be honest. But unless it, you know, I know if it's a yelling match, not to
get out notes on your phone.
Just one sec, Bridget. I'm just going to record a voice memo here.
If you could just... I'm just going to put the phone in between us.
Why are you a prick? That'll make sense later on. But my mind is so easy. I've thought about going and seeing somebody for it, where I could, like... My lack of focus sometimes is astounding. And that's... I think it's a selfish thing that we do, to be honest. And maybe other... Maybe you're very good at compartmentalizing and staying in the moment, but I imagine we all drift off to a point, like, yeah, and like you very rarely have my full attention.
Well, I've thought about it a lot, just in relation to you know, this show that I've done, because I'm coming to the end of it now and I'm starting to think about what the next show will be. And so you do have that kind of moment to sort of think about how being in the moment and experiencing things in a real way is still very important. Like, I think that there is part of what we do that if you're constantly feeding your life into things, that essentially you're looking at your life as a content creation machine rather than just being able to go, no, I'm just in this moment and I'm in this experience, right? And I, you know, in a relationship that must be, you know, particularly I think if you are, I don't write a lot of stuff about my relationship. So it's reasonably easy for me to be this is the relationship and this is my work, because they're not actually very intertwined. And it's I don't have kids and it's not part of my... So it's not like I have to... But I still see it. I still see the idea that you eventually go, well, this bad thing that is happening to us right now, it would actually be better for me as a human being if I just experienced it as a bad thing rather than that one part of my brain going, nah, this will make a really funny bit.
Yeah. I think it depends on how deep the trouble is at the time. Like you said, there are times where I do clock it, or maybe I don't even realize it at the moment because I am focused. I'm not never focused and in the moment with Bridge. You know, like if we're having a proper serious conversation, but sometimes Bridge will tell me about stuff about you know, something that happened in traffic. She describes traffic a lot to me, and I think too much. I had to say to her recently, I said, when you're talking to me about traffic and you're talking about all the roads and when you're trying to pinpoint, you know, get the sat nav in my brain to kind of, you know, sync up with yours, it takes me a long time to actually kind of work out where it is and where you are. And then I'm behind in the conversation and I'm just playing catch up.
Yeah.
And it's hard. So I just want you to know that that's something, you know, because it's sometimes, you know, like Bridget, she can move quickly, you know, and like she'll say something like, she'll say something to me and I'm like, oh, what did you say? And she'll say to me, maybe we're in different rooms, and I ask again, what did you say? And then she'll go, oh, no, it doesn't matter. You get two chances. And then it's over. So sometimes we shall say something and I'm just trying to, I didn't quite catch it and I'm just trying to work it out. I'm trying to go, what this, you know, can we replay that in my brain? Can we, and so sometimes I'm faking it. I go, yeah. And I'm just faking it, hoping it comes to me. And then all of a sudden she's halfway through this story about, you know, her auntie who's, you know, sick or something. And I'm just going, what's she talking about? I'm lost. And then, you know, she'll work out. She goes, you know what I'm talking about, do you? I'm like, oh, sorry, I didn't catch a start. But sometimes I say, just if I ask a third time, just tell me.
Yeah.
So we can start at the same
page. Yeah. The reason that I am behind on this story was I was scared that if I ask again, the whole story
is over. It is pure fear.
Yeah. all right. Let's. I want to ask if you have a philosophy towards something, because that's kind of the broad conceit of the podcast. So. How long? Oh, yeah, we made it 30 minutes in before I got to that. That's not too bad, actually. Okay. I'm all right with that. But I'm going to use this opportunity, because there's a natural break, to use the bathroom, and we'll start again. I'm glad we weren't recording for that, because Pete and I just had the just such an old man conversation about how often we need to go to the toilet.
Seriously,
remember when we were young and cool doing stand-up, Pete? Starting out down at, you know, elbow grease at the Nicholson, being young and thinking that we were going to be like, you know, rock and roll comedians with the world in front of us, and now we're just two old men sitting around talking about how often we have to work.
That was a blink of an eye, I know, wasn't it? But I'm terrible. I sometimes on planes I find it really embarrassing, because sometimes, you know, you get recognised. And when if it's a long haul flight, I might need to go quite a few times if I've had a couple of drinks as well.
Yeah,
but
once it starts,
I sometimes come out just stop playing with my nostrils and sniffing like I've just had cocaine. It's less embarrassing.
Yeah, or just asking a random passenger, going, "Could you just come out of the bathroom after me?" So people think I'm joining the Mile High Club or something. I promise nothing has to happen.
Nothing ever just, yeah.
I just don't want people to know how often I wee.
Yeah, let's come out. I'll give you a high five before you go back to your seat. Just to you.
Philosophy. Do you have one towards something? Is there one that you have as a guiding principle?
A couple. One actually, which I'll kick off with, because I feel like it kind of involves you in a weird way, which is never, always, I only judge people by my own experience. And the reason I say it may involve you, and I'm not sure if I've ever told you this, but we started out doing comedy. I started out a year or two after you, maybe two after you. I started in 96. And we didn't actually meet for a little while. Like, when I say a little while, it might have been months, 6 months or something. But I'd seen you, and I think you'd done Diet Life.
Yeah, sure.
Some contemporaries of ours had said to me, that's Will. They said, he's a lovely guy, but he won't like you. And I was like, why won't he like me? And they said, he might be a little threatened or something. Because I was experiencing a little, like, as we all do when you first, not all, but I feel like you have like a 6 month little glow about you, or even a year or so, where, you know, and I think Adam Richard was kind of experiencing that a little bit when I came on, and he said just before me, and then I had a little, you know, moment in the sun of, you know, being, oh, this is a new kid, is, you know, I think Michelle Mallory described me as a puppy in one of her books that everybody wanted to play with for a short period of time. So I was just like, and then I met you, and then you were like, hey, I've seen your stuff, and you're funny, and it's great, you're as lovely as you could have been. And I reckon we got to know each other more, and about 2 years, at the back of my brain, I'm just like, what? What is it? When's he gonna reveal that he doesn't like me? when am I gonna see it?
Well, it's funny that but this is why I invited you over today, babe. Going on a new direction with Will Ossoby this season. Wow, I'm going to invite a whole bunch of people over and rip the carpet from under them.
And then it was like maybe 2 or 3 years later, I just went, oh, they were wrong. And it's so funny that it happened with you, because the bigger picture, if we were to press enlarge, 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 is nobody's more supportive of new comics and you know, the industry as you are. Now, you may have had that, probably you've evolved in that and developed over, you know, and that comes with years of confidence and all, but there was never any sign of that for me,
but here's what I always say to that, and like, I mean, I always say I'm the worst person to ask about you know, my past, because, you know, you constantly reframe who you were based on who you are now.
Yes.
Right?
Yep, yep.
You know, you see your prism of your life then through who you have become now. Yep, and we're all guilty of this. You know, like if I wrote an autobiography, it'd have to be called Based on a True Story, because, like, that's all it would be. You know, like, it wouldn't be a true story. It would be my interpretation through my eyes now of what had happened. Yep. But that wouldn't necessarily be accurate. But my best guess is, like, you know, knowing what I was like, was when we first started, and I think this is why we got along quite well immediately, was the fact that it was a couple of years after I started. Mm. I think perhaps, you know, somewhere where that would have come from would have been from contemporaries of mine when we started. And when you all are strangers coming into this place, and none of us knew what we were doing, because back then there wasn't this sort of, you couldn't listen to podcasts or read, you know, comedy websites or YouTube, blogs or any of these sort of things. You know, we were constantly trying to work out, much like children in a way, what works and what doesn't work. And often before you know how to define yourself, you often define yourself, you know, teenagers are very big on this. You define yourself by what you don't like before it is you can work out what you do like.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. You know?
Yeah.
I don't have the confidence or the pride or the contentment with myself to be going, it's okay just to like what I like.
Yeah.
I have to define myself as much by saying I don't like that, and I don't like this, and I don't like that person. And like, The only kind of, in my opinion, and I mean, I may not be the best person to ask about this, but the only people within the industry that I have any kind of, you know, poor relationships with are people who I established those poor relationships with in those first couple of years.
Right, yeah.
And not entirely on me, by the way, you know, the fact that we were all bringing that same sort of energy, and by the very nature of that, then if you were two kind of opposite people and you're both kind of bringing that sort of like, I'm trying to define myself by what I'm not, then that's what happens. Now, then we all kind of get older and more confident and realize that it's a big, glorious world and you don't have to define yourself by what you're not. You can just define yourself by what you are. And I think you and I met at a point where I was moving into more of a defining myself by what I was and less by what I wasn't stage.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, there was never any kind of, and I was, you know, there was part of me that was looking for it because I would be, you know, it was in my mind. I was going like, okay, and I, you know, you were, and still are, I believe, a very cool guy. And the thing I love about getting older is that, like, cool people used to intimidate me.
Right.
You know? So I remember the first time I saw you, you walked into the cook bar, you had a backpack on, and, you know, you probably just come from your gig. So that guy wears a backpack pretty cool. You know? And he doesn't like me. Why doesn't he like me? And one of the things I like about getting older is you see through cool. You know, you see that, you know that everyone's a bit vulnerable and everyone's got insecurities and everyone, it comes from a certain place, and some people lead with cool and other people just become cool because of they themselves, or, you know. But like I said, I was kind of looking for it. I never saw it. Not in a glance, not in a kind of a little wisecrack, not in a, you know, it was only friendship and support, you know. So that, and I really kind of thought, okay, I can't listen to people talk about other people who, you know, it's got to be based on my own experience. Occasionally there's exceptions, you know, Hitler.
If you didn't know about the whole, I really only know him from art school. Vegetarian. Met him, he had Vienna. A sharp look. Hang on, what did you do after art school? What? Oh, that. Hang on, that's not the same. Oh my god! Wow. Oh boy.
Whoa.
Just reconnected with him on Facebook, and
he painted some flowers one day.
I mean, but we've all got. Funnily enough, I know that we're kind of, I mean, joking around that, but. Like, I have a friend online, like a high school friend, who has become very right-wing and is constantly posting, you know, those sort of right-wing. And again, in the time where I knew him, you never would have... It wasn't like as a teenager, he was like, you know, stop the boats and, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, he has become that. So there may well have been people who... there would have been people I went to uni with who never would have imagined I would have been a stand-up comedian. So there's got to be people that went to art school with Hitler who were like...
Yeah.
I mean, of all the guys.
Yeah, we used to hang out. We used to go to the Putters Club together. It was, you know.
I liked him.
Yeah.
There was a few in the course I didn't like.
Well, and the thing that I think about a lot in the current climate is that, you know, there'll be people, you know, the Me Too movement, will there'll be more things to come out with that. And there'll be people, who knows, who we're going to have to reframe relationships and friendships with based on, you know, there's a couple of things, people who have been kind of named, and it's less of a shock. And there are a couple who have been named that I'm like, oh, I had no idea. And these people, you kind of know. I'm not close with anyone who have been kind of named, but you kind of go, I don't know. I do think of, like, when that happens, if that happens to somebody I'm, you know, friends with, like, that's going to be a weird moment.
Well, I think with all those sort of things that it's as much about how someone who's made a mistake previously, and look, there's not anybody in the entire world who hasn't behaved in a way at some stage, whether it be something as serious as, like, you know, the top end of Me Too through to, you know, just, you know, casual racism or, you know, words that we've used. Like, I mean, I talk about it with the podcast all the time. My other podcast, well, this one, I mean, there will be times I'll look back on 3 or 4 years and there'll be some language I used or an attitude that I had on a topic that, you know, that I've changed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's important. And I hope that we keep all that. You know, I hope we keep that capacity to not cancel someone forever if that person makes a genuine attempt to understand what they did was wrong and put in place, you know, some sort of commitment to. There should be, if there is no path for redemption for people, then there's no incentive for people to redeem themselves.
Yeah.
However, I think that you are, like, funnily enough, with the Louis stuff, for example, you know, and I don't know Louis, but I have worked with Louis and I was an admirer of his stand-up comedy. And I think to some people, it seemed on the less, it wasn't Weinstein or Cosby, right?
Yeah.
And I think that some people have been more disappointed with the way that he has almost, that they could have, if he'd handled dealing with what happened and his road back from it better, they would have been more accepting for him to have that road back.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it seems like, you know, it's the misjudging or the, I mean, I don't want to say this because I don't think this is a fair thing to say, but I'm going to say it, which is I've almost judged him worse. I would have been able to go, look, he did this terrible thing 10 years ago. He certainly never should have put, you know, those women in that position. Like, I understand absolutely every aspect of that. However, it seems from what we've heard, none of that has happened for a decade. You know, this is all historical stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like he's been, if you stop doing something, there's an acknowledgement in that that you have come to an understanding that what you thought was acceptable is not acceptable.
Yeah.
And that perhaps he was haunted by that and has been dealing with that and recovering from that and, you know, forging a new path forward. And I think that there is a capacity there to kind of move forward. And it almost disappoints me that that isn't how the comeback has happened. If that makes sense. Like, we are going to find out things about people that we like all the time that are terrible, but it's how the person deals with that terrible thing that almost defines them as much as...
Yeah. No, I agree. And last night on the project, we were talking about Scott Morrison's comments on Pamela Anderson in regards to Julian Assange, and Lisa Wilkinson did a nice piece about how disappointed she was in the comments. And then Steve Price was on the panel, so he was
being Steve Price.
Being a little bit Steve Price and trying to excuse it to an extent. And I made the point, which I think is worth making here, is that men, we need to allow men to evolve, you know, and to, because when I first saw those comments, I didn't listen, I saw him in Twitter feed. I didn't really think much about him, but I was surprised it blew up as much as it did, to be absolutely honest. But when Lisa did her piece, I could, if you just stop and listen, you can see how something like that, the message that sends to women and the message it also sends to men, and you go, oh, all these things are connected. So if we just, instead of getting defensive, just listen. And then, if you want to say something after you've listened and ask questions, you should. But defensiveness is not a very good first station. You know, it shouldn't be your go-to. We do need to listen. And if you're listening, you know, you'll evolve.
I think that so much of... Because I think about this all the time. You know, I think about, you know, that we have worked in an industry that is... been predominantly men,
yeah,
you know, and that we thought nothing of the fact that you would go and do a show and there might be all men on it, or there might be a woman on the show, because it was just how things were. And the world that's built up around that is, well, there's just not enough women doing comedy, so this is, like, you know, this is how it is or whatever. And it isn't until you, like you said, you take a moment to genuinely listen, you know, to hear these stories that are being told by everybody and say, oh, okay, well, I had never thought of that. And it wasn't, and the reason I hadn't thought of it wasn't because I was intentionally not thinking about it. I was just literally living in a world where it had never even been brought up. or considered to me.
Yeah.
And so there's this element of, I think, I judge people a lot of the time, I think, and myself, like within this, which is, what did you do and how did you behave once you knew?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'll judge myself less on, but yeah, saying a certain word or behaving in a certain way before I knew that that was not a thing that I should be doing. But then it's that step afterwards when someone says, hey, could you please not, you know, use the R word for mentally, you know, or for disabled people or for whatever, you know, don't use that word. And then you're like, I'm just going to keep using it.
Yeah.
I've heard what you've said. Yeah. And
well, that was the thing.
Does that make sense?
To go back to the Adam Goods thing, and I had a really, you know, an argument with a friend of mine who was like, for me, the Adam Goods thing comes down to the fact that when he came out and said, and he took a week or two off playing football, he said, I'm not coping with this. You know, it's all gotten to me. I'm having some mental issues with it. That's your cue for everyone to stop.
Yeah.
Whether you stop arguing whether it's racism or it's booing or whether it's that's where does the whole Australian giving a bloke a fair go kind of, where does that kind of fall? How does that disappear so quickly? And my friend was like, I go to the footy and I can vent and I can do whatever I like. So, well, no, you can't actually. You can't stab a child who's sitting next to you because they're bearing for, you know, even Collingwood. You can't do that. And, you know, like, just common decency. When somebody has come out and said, you know, I'm struggling with this. Can you help, you know, read between the lines. Can you help me out a little bit? And your response is, get fucked.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because that, before that, you could be like, I boo at the footy, Adam Goods, because many of the things that people said. I boo Adam Goods because he's a champion player for a team that is the opposite to my team.
Yep.
And I believe he dives in on people's legs or whatever. Let's just use that as an example, right? Okay, you're allowed to boo somebody for that reason.
Yeah.
But then when a whole bunch of people, and it's clear a whole bunch of people are booing in a racist way, it's hard to tell that you're booed for a different point.
Yeah.
That would be the time where I'd be like, you know what? Like, I mean, there was people who had the Southern Cross tattoo before the Southern Cross tattoo was a sign you were a dickhead, right? Oh, and, you know.
I remember thinking, somebody asked me years ago, you know, teenager or early 20s, if you were to get a tattoo, what would you get? And I'd be like, well, a magpie, because I'm a passionate Collingwood fan, and probably the Southern Cross, you know, because I'm never going to be not proud of being Australian.
Right. And it's not really that jingoistic. I mean, it's just the constellation. It's not like the flag or anything.
It's all right, isn't it?
It's just a really...
Dang. Fuck, I didn't do that. I mean, you know, it'd be in a place where I'd never take my clothes off anyway, so it's not, you know, nobody would see it, but still, I would know.
You could have one of those Sons of Anarchy-style back tattoos and nobody would ever know.
I could have a Ben Affleck tattoo on my back. Nobody would ever know.
I like that idea of only trying to judge people through your own experience with those people. I think that's a really... a strong thing. And as I get older, I think I have less and less time to for just like there are a few lingering people that I feel awkward around or don't have good relationships with. And as you get older, it just becomes almost like you're just like, I just can't be bothered. Like I'd rather this be fine just so that I don't have to be bothered with this being, you know, and I don't really even want to be in a situation with, around people or in a work situation or in a life situation with people that I, you know, don't find pleasant to, you know, hang out with and work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you do. That's what I love about getting older. You just kind of realize what's important. You're a bit more comfortable in your own skin. And I guess one of my other philosophies is don't make anyone's day harder than it needs to be. And because I need to connect with the joy of what I'm doing. Because what I'm doing is amazing. This is what I'm doing, everything I ever wanted to do. You know, I mean, maybe when I was a kid, you're kind of dreaming that you might be in a Hollywood movie to a big blockbuster. But, like, you know, relatively, I'm doing everything I wanted to do. I wanted to always wanted to be eclectic. I wanted to write some books. I wanted to, you know, be on a Tonight Show. I wanted to be in a sketch show. I wanted to make a movie. You know, I could not be happier. And And I think you've spoken a lot about on this show about connecting with that kind of 14-year-old boy, you know, and that I always think of that. I always kind of think of, you know, me in my bedroom, you know, as a 14-year-old in Bundoora, and I'm just, you know, I'm just writing, and if I had a pen and paper in my hand, I was happy, and I'm, you know, and I'm in year 10 and or year 9, and the humanities teacher has asked me to kind of during oral presentations to sit at the desk and introduce people to do their presentations in the Steve Izard style. I'm just, you know, I did work experience at Fast Forward, you know, and looking, you know, Ted Emery over there, the direct famous director, and Magda and Marg, and just like all my dreams have come true. So I've got no, I need to kind of remain connected to that joy. And, you know, I had an experience, you know, some, you know, with doing breakfast radio with a man who I loved and who he was extremely talented, who on the final day of our last day of the year, we went out, had drinks to celebrate, gave him a hug, invited him to Christmas at my house if he wanted to because he was from interstate, get the call the next day that he killed himself, you know. And I always, you always wonder, you know, you always wonder, was his days being made the best possible, you know, as good as it can be, you know. And there's no blame, you know, to anyone. But I, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say. I wonder, you know, if everyone was making his day as good as it could possibly be every day. And there are times, you know, I'm sure we all get frustrated and you know, with certain people and all that, but just not to, you know, I try to think of everybody's parents, you know, that they've got parents who are worried about them, you know, and they've got family and friends and they go home, you know, this is a workplace.
It's every, so it's a theme that's
come up. Oh, no, sorry, I went off in a hole.
No, that's good. Absolutely. I love this because it's a theme that's come up a lot on this podcast before, and it was actually one of the themes of my show, which was, you know, despite this like thing I'm telling you, the thing that haunted me the most about it was on this day, I was somebody's worst day at work.
Yeah.
You know, on this day,
Yeah,
this wasn't fun for them. They were clearly worried enough about some situation, even though it turned out to be a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Like, in the moment, they didn't know that it was a misunderstanding. In the moment, I was their worst day at work.
And
one of my great themes that I try to live by is like, don't be somebody's worst day at work. You know, like, don't be the person that they go home and complain to their partner about. And I remember I was just at the airport the other day, like you know, I always get, for whatever reason, I think it's because I am a slow packer of my stuff. I take all my stuff out, and then when it goes through the machine, I'm a slow packer. I always get the, you know, bomb thing.
Right, yeah.
But
yeah,
the other thing is, I know how to do it, and it takes 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And so I've started, rather than going, oh, this again, I've started going the other way, which is just be, these people are dealing with frustrated, you know, grumpy people all the time. Just be the light of their day. Be the one person who opens the bag, who's really nice to them, who asks them how their day's going, who makes some sort of, and you see it.
Oh,
like,
mate,
it's almost, it's more rewarding than doing a whole show. In that 30 seconds, you can see someone who's just used to getting this procession of grumpy, you know, frustrated. Again, we also have more experience traveling and these sort of things. So often at the airport, it's heightened emotions. It's people are running late. They're in a strange environment. So they're not at their best, you know. And you can give someone just that moment that makes their day a little bit better. There's some great joy in that.
I do exactly the same thing. And I had this same experience because I was a little bit like, oh, yeah, they've picked me again. You know? I think anyone with a public profile think so, probably always are getting picked on. And then I had the thought of going, well, if they are picking me because they know who I am, then fine.
Right.
Fine. Because they are standing at the end of a, you know, a carousel or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
For however many hours, 6 hours a day, whatever.
Yeah.
If they can bomb check my bag
right,
so that we're all safe and I can, you know, I did exactly the same thing. I just, I was, for a little while, I was a bit like, oh, okay, you chose me again, have you? and this kind of going, "G'day, mate. How you doing? Yeah, no worries." And it's, and, you know, I find sometimes, even sometimes in traffic, letting somebody in as opposed to trying to get in front of them can just instantly make you feel a bit better,
right,
in your own mind.
I mean, it does. That's the other thing that we kind of forget, or that we just don't get told all the time. Because I think, you know, that part of it is probably the way that we're sold to in the world, which is the, you know, individualism and advertising and capitalism revolve around those concepts a little bit, which is self-advancement. But there is great joy in doing things for other people. And I think that we forget to tell people that you can actually make your day a little bit better by just taking 30 seconds out of your day to make someone else's day a little bit better.
I think we treat kindness as a very frivolous thing. That it's just, it's nice to be kind. If you can be kind, it's good. But it's actually, it's much more important than that. And I wish I did more, like, you know, bigger kind of acts of kindness. But I'm just a bit busy at the moment.
Don't you understand? I've got two TV shows. I've got a children's book to flog. I've got to run your stand-up show. You know what? If you want me to be kind to you, come along, pay $55. I'll be really entertaining for 70 minutes.
If you don't think I've been kind to you, I'll probably let you into traffic at some point. So just... back off.
If you haven't enjoyed tonight's show, I did let you into traffic the other day, so... But I think that we also think that kindness almost has to be without its own reward. And if you get, like, you hear this thing of going, oh, they're just doing that to make themselves feel good.
I do not understand people saying that.
You're like, well, good. Good. If it makes the other person feel good and it makes them feel good, isn't that a double bonus? That shouldn't be something that... It's like the people who are like, oh, well, this gives you all the side effects of marijuana, but you don't get that nice high. And you're like, why? Why did you take out that bit that was also...
Well, one of the strangest terms of it, you know, is the term do-gooder. Like, it's always said negatively. He's a do-gooder. What a fucking do-gooder. Yeah. It's like, what, he's doing good? Yeah. Now, you understand where it's turned, because people might try to rub their goodness in other people's faces. That's probably where it has gotten a bad name. But still, people are doing good things.
I know. Oh, well, I imagine even in, like, you know, a Metropolis, there were people going, Superman, he's just a do-gooder, isn't he? Just virtue signaling. That's what he is. Social justice warrior.
Only rocks up when we're in trouble.
Yeah. For the glory.
Always gets write-ups in the Daily... What's the newspaper?
The Daily Planet.
I was going to say Daily Mail. Yeah, Daily Planet.
Yeah, he ended up working at the Daily Mail.
That's a funny sketch. Clark Kent now working at the Daily Mail. Just following Kerry Bickmore around.
I think that the idea that kindness can be good for you as well is something that, as our society, we have... Like, I find it so weird, because you can actually go, it doesn't even, like, in some ways, me being kind to that person at the airport, I don't get to see the results of whether that did. I'm imagining in some ways that I was the bright spot in their day. Maybe I wasn't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe I was the annoying guy, and they like the fact that everybody else just shuts up and they can wave their wand and they move on, whereas I'm all chatty McChat, like, how's your day? When do you knock off?
I'd love if one day they said, mate, I'm at work. Just mate, let me check your bags, please.
Mate, we're not mates. Like, I'm asking the guy about what he's doing when he's knocking off work. I'm like, do you have a nap in the afternoon? He's like, mate, none of your business. This is a transaction. I'm just working out if you're a terrorist or not, mate.
You know? And the way you're acting, I'm kind of thinking you are.
Yeah, why do you need to know my schedule all of a sudden? And when I'm sleeping. All right. So the idea of... I guess kindness, for the actual reward of kindness, is something that I think, I don't know why, I don't understand necessarily why, but you've always struck me as somebody who is, I think, you know, kindness is something that is even a theme of your work. Like, I mean, you've never been a person who, you know, your stuff has been particularly nasty or particularly vicious. I mean, I'm sure there have been times where you've, you know, done that joke or that line or whatever that has been. But as a general rule, you know, your comedy doesn't seem to come from a place of, you know, that sort of snarkiness. It comes from a place of sort of kindness.
Yeah, it's funny sometimes because and I don't like nastiness. And there are sometimes, like, I've got no interest in any of those comedy roasts that have kind of become popular. I've just got no interest in it. And
yeah, I've got, you know, no interest also because I don't really want to know what people think about me. Well, that way.
Part of it, like, possibly that, I'm like, as well.
Yeah, you should be inside my brain. I'm constantly doing a comedy roast to myself. I don't need other people's jokes to add to it as well. If it was just like me, my entire show is essentially a comedy roast of me. Here's another dickhead thing that I've done.
Hey, right now, Sarah Silverman's tearing me apart in here. but it's funny because sometimes I'll do stuff on the project and I will get complaints saying, oh, you know, that's nasty. Why did you pick on that person, you know, who was doing a vox pop in Adelaide because over the burst water main or something? And I just have a reaction of like, oh, I never thought of it as making fun of. We're just kind of showing, you know, they jumped in front of a camera, they spoke, and, you know, something was funny about it. It's, you know, and we are very careful with, if we think they've got any kind of issue, that we don't show it. So we do actually have a filter. And so as much as I don't go for that, sometimes, you know, occasionally I'll get accused of being that way. But no, I don't particularly like nastiness.
It always struck me too that you seem like one of our contemporaries who, when, you know, for a lot of us it was about, you know, I don't know, like, you know, living the lifestyle as much as, you know, doing the job.
Mm.
That you always were a person who, you know, well, I mean, maybe you weren't. I'd like to ask you. But, you know, you seemed amongst our group to be the person who settled down a bit earlier, you know.
Well, I remember looking around. So at the Rove office, so I started Rove in 1999. It was the first year at Channel 9. And I started comedy in 96. So it all happened pretty quickly. And I looked around at that office, and there was office of about 30 people, and there was one person who was married, and that was Margaret Chong, our accountant, and she was in her 40s, I guess. And I thought, oh, is this what where comedy leads, like, you know, and TV, and like there's people working so hard that they don't form relationships. And that was all in my own head. It wasn't, you know, I was just really getting to know these people. But something I did, having a family was always very important to me. I always wanted it, you know. And so I did have, you know, I've enjoyed myself, you know, and the early days of my comedy career was just some of my best memories, you know, hanging out with you and the guys at Elbow Grease and going back to the Punters Club and drinking out of dirty plastic pots and just getting to know each other and just look at what we're doing. This is amazing. And you know, going from the ESPY on a Sunday to Elbow Grease and this, you know, getting your first gig at a comedy club and
had the guy in today who's reopening, one of the guys who's reopening the ESPY. And as he talked about, you know, what they've done to the Gersh and all these sort of things, I was really like, oh, wow, I'm having like a really emotional connection to that time and a memory of that time and how exciting that time was. Like, in a way that, you know, playing the Sydney Opera House doesn't give you the same level of excitement as, like, you know, the first time you got a Tuesday night at the ESPY or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Or when Dave Torino asked you to do the cheese shop, you know, when comedians will say nice things to you, you know, like, you know, I remember specific things that, like, Matt King would say to me, you know, and Ellen Rowe, and like just take me aside and say, you're killing it, you know, and it meant a lot, you know, like, and now some people might say something nice, you're going, oh, thanks,
yeah,
you know?
Right,
cool. But, you know, then it just meant everything because you meant, oh, you know, maybe I'm on the right path, maybe I can do this. But yeah, the connection I have with those first few years. And the people like you and Husey and Rove and, you know, Michelle Laurie, Adam Richard, the guy who were doing the same rooms as we were, and, you know, there's another dozen, tripod, you know, and the road show that we did, you know, together. I think we the very first Comedy Festival road show.
That's right.
You, me, Corinne Grant, tripod, Keith Robinson, and then he was replaced with Russ Noble halfway through. I think that's that was Matt King.
Yeah, Matt King. That's right.
It was amazing. And I wish...
I mean, so much fun. Like, I mean, we've told this story before, but one of the early dates on that roadshow was my hometown where I'd grown up. And so I did this thing about, you know, I'm from here.
Oh, yeah.
And it became the running joke of the show. Everybody said they were from here. And of course, Keith Robinson, who's this, you know, black American New York comedian, like came out. I remember he just says, it's good to be home. And it was like...
You do little secrets out. We gifted him the best. Has anyone been gifted a better punchline to walk into a, you know, a country town in Australia? Like, I love that man. He came out a couple of years ago to Australia, and I caught up with him a couple of times. But and we've kind of occasionally swapped messages. But he was funny. He was great. But like this, that, and kind of because you're getting paid as well. So you kind of remember buying a Stussy jacket in one of the towns, and you know, that was exciting. And you know, Matt King got me into Gomez, the band.
That's
you know,
right. Well, I was just in Townsville, which was where Ross Noble wrapped himself in bubble wrap and came out on the conveyor belt. I mean, not a thing they'd let you do at an airport anymore, but it was a different time. It was pre-9/11.
Oh, yeah. Jeez, it was too, yeah.
Yeah.
But I, I kind of, and I would love to do another, I have a real, like, you know, hunger to do another roadshow. It's just like, it's not going to happen anytime soon, I don't think. But yeah, great times.
Okay. Well, we need to finish up soon because you've got to get to work. But I always ask a couple of questions. So I want to cover those off, which is okay. So, religion, are you religious at all?
Raised a Catholic and went to Catholic schools. My kids go to Catholic schools. I still don't know what it's about. I kind of spoke about it in one of my shows for you a couple of years ago. I don't know, maybe I haven't dedicated enough time to thinking about it, but I don't know. I know you're going to ask about what happens after we die. I don't know. I think,
well, no one knows.
It's not like I'm
running a quiz.
Next week's episode of Philosophy, the answers are revealed.
Yeah, I've been doing a survey, and I'm just working out who knows. I know, and I'm just asking other people to see if they also know.
There's a winner. There's a meat tray involved.
Yeah.
I don't quite feel like it's completely over. I feel like there's too many amazing things that happen. I'd lean towards the spiritual more than religion, I think. But I don't practice much of it. I just kind of believe that it's pretty fucking amazing. And I'm not sure if science covers all of it. So I like to think there's something. I don't necessarily believe that there's... We're going to be walking around on clouds. But I think we just might be somehow out there in the ether. Maybe as particles. as a spirit.
Just the vibe.
The vibe. It's Marbo. It's the vibe.
It's the universe.
Dennis Donato had it all wrapped up many years ago. But
Well, okay. So with that in mind then, if it's not something that you, you know, and look, it's nothing. You know, I guess the question that comes with that and the thing that I'm more interested in than is why do you do what you do? Like, what drives you to create? What drives you to love? What gets you out of bed in the morning? Like, what are those things motivated by? Because there's a bit of a, you know, kind of a myth of like organized religion, which is without these rules of organized religion, how do you define your life, and how do you be a good person if you don't know that if you do these things you're going to hell, or you know, some version of that. How is it that you define what's important to you, and you know, you decide, you know, what it is that you're going to put your energy and your passion into, and what your life, you know, is about?
I mean, I'll say that I have no regrets, obviously, because I still send my kids to a Catholic, they have Catholic education. So I was really, really thankful for the education I got. I think it's given me a good, whether I believe stuff or not, it's given me a good moral compass. and that's come from my parents as well. And I've seen my grandparents get through a whole lot of stuff, from war to, you know, deaths of children, with faith. And I don't think it's important that you have faith in a God, but I think it's nice if you have faith in something. And I think I just want, you often think, I think most people, you probably think, okay, at the end of it, what is there? And I want hopefully to leave some kind of legacy, not for the world, but for the people around me, you know, my kids. It's funny, I started thinking about my kids before I had them. I was a teenager and I was kind of thinking, what kind of man do I want to be so my kids can see? I was living my life with my kids years before I'd even met the person who I'd have those kids with, you know. And it's, so I think I want to just help them navigate the world and some, you know, life. And sometimes I, like, and I, my dad used to do it and it used to drive me mad, and I've fallen into the same trap where I'm trying to pass on too many lessons, you know. Often after sport, you know, like, you know, this and that and this and that and this and that, and, you know, and it's, I've gotten better at just kind of knowing, just take a step back, let them go through their little thing, and then when the moment's right, you know, you can come in. Yeah, one of our boys had something that they were a bit disappointed with, something didn't quite go the way they were hoping, and, you know, I just kind of handled it, you know, in a very kind of, just said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You'll get another chance. You'll be back. And, you know, the same thing happened to me. Happens to a lot of people. Just let them know that they weren't alone in what they were going through. And I think years ago, I would have been, well, why did it happen?
Yeah.
Shouldn't have happened. You're better than this.
Here's why it happened.
Yeah.
Here's where it went wrong. And here's how you can address it next time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, instead of saying, oh, yeah, we've all... And I think, you know, if we talk on a broader sense, you know, that I think has some real correlation to the world that we're in now, where we're very, you know, willing and ready to point out to people what they did wrong and how they should have done it better, instead of taking a little step back and going, oh, yeah, I've fucked up shit too.
Absolutely.
Like, I've made major mistakes too, and you're not alone in going through this. And it's how you come back from this that will define you as much as what has just happened.
And that's what I said. I said, it's not a bad thing to have this a little, let's call it a failure, before you're about to go into a few years of, like, you know, exams and that kind of stuff, where this is something that's not actually, but you can, you know, you can do it again. You'll be fine. But this will be fine. And funny enough, there was a quote that somebody used on the project at night, which I kind of, from Nelson Mandela, which I felt a little bit hacky kind of quoting Nelson Mandela. You feel like a little bit David Brent as soon as you say Nelson Mandela. You know? But he said, I thought it was great. He said, I never fail. I succeed or I learn. Which has the, I love it because it's got the economy of a stand-up comedian. You know, like, it's just, it's word perfect. And, but it's true. And I said, what did you do today? And he kind of just laughed and he said, I succeeded, joking. And I said, oh, maybe you learned. And that was it. And that was, you know, it was nice. So,
Justin and I were just in Noosa, and backstage they had all the previous people who, you know, like, yeah, who, yeah, performed there and kind of graffitied the wall
in
the theatre. And one of them was a Nelson Mandela musical. And I was so disappointed that it hadn't been called A Long Dance to Freedom. I was like, surely if you're going to do a musical about Nelson Mandela, that's what you've got to call it. Hey, Pete, I've got to let you go because you've got to get to work. But it has been an absolute pleasure. So the reason we are slotting this one in, even though I'm not back officially, is that I want people to be able to watch your TV show, which is How to Stay Married. It's on Channel 10. How many episodes?
We are eight episodes we are for this series.
And when this comes out, how many have been? It's been two already, three already?
Two to air. As of today, and Thursday nights at 8:30 now. It was 9 o'clock after the Bachelorette, but it's gone back to 8:30.
Ten play as well, or
ten
some
play
sort of catch up?
And encores have been on Monday nights. After have you been paying attention? But that's now finished. So there'll be maybe a shift. But look at your guides. If you've got kids, get them in the reading. Frankie Fish series is gone great. There's three books, a fourth one out in April, and the project. Nice. And I'm doing a show at the Comedy Festival next year.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Awesome. It's about me reading the books that I wrote as a kid. So it's actually for family. It's actually, I did it as a family show at the Yak Festival.
Right.
So we had like kids of all ages. This one I'm kind of pitching for 14 years and up. But it's a stroll down nostalgia lane, you know, for parents, because there's the books that I wrote, and there's references to Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, Star Wars, Mr. Wong in the American Express ad.
I mean, it sounds like Ready Player One. You might Spielberg might make this into a movie.
You might be right. If you're listening, Stephen, yeah. I can comp you. But there's all that stuff.
Ah, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for being part of this, mate. I really appreciate that you made the time. And thanks to everyone for listening. My new show probably is on sale now. For Melbourne Comedy Festival. So buy some tickets for that. That'd be handy. Thanks, guys.
Awesome.
Bye.